It's Thinking Out Loud from KBIA. Coming up this weekend, the historian Andrew Carroll is going to be speaking at the State Historical Society of Missouri as they do their Center for Missouri Studies Fall Lecture. It'll be Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Courtyard by Marriott, the conference center over by 63 and Nifong here in Columbia. His new book is called My Fellow Soldiers, General John Pershing and the Americans Who Helped Win the Great War. And he joins us on the phone. Andy, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
It's great to be with you. Thank you so much.
Of course, we're talking about one of the great Missourians, as we talk about General Pershing. And it's an interesting book in that it kind of combines a lot of different things. We've got, obviously, a lot of biography. A lot of it is stories about the war. But there's also some very personal stories about individuals within the war. So we've got a lot to talk about. Very early in the book is the telling of the story of the fire at the Presidio, which would take the life of the wife and young daughters of General Pershing, leaving only one son behind, and he would just about immediately leave to be fighting in Mexico and then in Europe. That incredible loss must really have affected him greatly as he's trying to focus on the work he's doing.
Oh, there's no question. And that story of the fire is really what kind of drew me in, not only to Pershing's story, but into World War One. So I'm a historian. I focus on military history. I've been doing it for almost 20 years. And what the lens that I see it through are the letters that troops have written from times of war. And this goes back. I run what's called the Center for American War Letters at Chapman University. And our whole mission is to preserve American correspondence. And we have letters going back from the Revolution through every major American war, going up to emails from Iraq and Afghanistan. Yeah. And that's kind of the perspective that I like to focus on, is what do the actual troops write in times of conflict? And I came across a bundle of letters by General Pershing that no one had ever really seen or published before. And there were letters that some that he wrote during the war when he was over in France serving as the commander of the AAF, and then some letters he had written before the war, before America had gotten involved in the war. The war had already started, but the U.S. was not officially entered. And they talked about the fire and this extraordinary grief that he felt, understandably, having lost his wife and his three little girls in a fire, and only six-year-old Warren was pulled out alive. And in fact, Warren was unconscious, so he didn't know anything that had happened. And one of the letters that I came across was Pershing writing to his wife's best friend. This is about 3 months after the fire. This is December of 1915. The fire had happened in August. And in the letter, Pershing tells Anne that I have not yet told Warren that he's lost his mother and his three sisters. And it was just, you know, I've read every biography on Pershing, and I really wanted to tell the human side of his story. And the same with the war. I didn't want to just write another kind of history book about World War One. I really wanted to for us to see it through the lens of what did these troops or the generals and the officers write in their correspondences? What do they put in their journals, in their diaries, in their memoirs? So I tried to make My Fellow Soldiers read more like a novel, but everything's true. It's all taken from the real words. I don't make up dialogue. I don't make up, you know, what they were thinking. I go by what they actually wrote. And one of my other favorite Missourians who I talk about at length is Harry Truman.
Yes.
And like Pershing, his war experience has been overlooked. And, you know, I remember reading history books about him coming into office as president, and everyone's like, this is a guy who had no experience, and he was, you know, a failed hat salesman from Missouri who, you know, lucked into being senator and then being vice president. This is a man who probably spent more time in combat than any president before him. And this is a man who was very acquainted with war. So both Pershing's story and Harry Truman's story are very prevalent in the book. And again, it's told through Truman's letters are at the Truman Library, and they are incredible. You can read some of them online as well, and they do a very good job of showing you the original and then also having a transcript. So it's, you know, just using those two men as examples, this is a very personal look at what war is like and just the weight of command that Pershing is under. A lot of people don't realize this. Pershing is the only general in American history to receive a sixth star in his lifetime.
Yes.
Now, General Washington was given one posthumously in 1976, kind of as an act of Congress, just because they felt no one should outrank Washington. But really, Pershing earned it in his lifetime. And he's also the only American general to lead the Allies to victory in a world war from start to finish. And he's the guy who mentored a young Eisenhower and Patton, and he knew MacArthur and so forth. So that's what I also tried to show, is just how influential Pershing was. I mean, I think Missouri should be very proud of this native son. And, you know, there's streets and places named after him, but I think the average American really doesn't know much about his story.
There is some time spent in the book on Pershing leading the hunt for Pancho Villa and some smaller skirmishes along the border, and a whole lot of chasing a guy that they would never catch through the countryside of Mexico. And when the U.S. finally does get into World War One, it seemed like that experience maybe would not have been comparable to what was going on in Europe, but it did give Pershing kind of a measure of experience that might have been lacking otherwise.
Well, and not only that, it really convinced President Wilson that Pershing was someone who he wanted to focus on, because there were other generals who outranked Pershing, both during the Pancho Villa expedition and then, of course, for World War One. And Wilson felt that Pershing, even though they never caught Pancho Villa, which Secretary of War Newton Baker said was a benefit, because he said if we caught him, we don't know what we would have done with him. So frankly, what we just wanted to send a message to Mexico of, do not send your bandits over here to cause trouble, otherwise we're going to retaliate. And so
anybody thinks that military leaders with a mind for PR is a thing of the modern day, there's an example that it's been around for a while.
Exactly. And that what Wilson was so impressed by was Pershing's cool, that he never kind of lashed out publicly. He always kept his temper, even though, you know, privately he could certainly show his anger about certain things, but that he was not just a great general, but he kind of understood, and that he stayed out of politics. Pershing had no desire to run for higher office. Some of the other generals who Wilson was considering, he knew, like McClellan eventually ran against Lincoln during the Civil War, that one of these generals might actually turn against Wilson and kind of run, you know, as an opposition candidate. Pershing was just not that way. And Pershing, I have to say, I mean, this should really not count for anything. He looks like a five-star general. I mean, he's like at a central casting. He was 6 foot tall, very handsome, blue eyes, and just, you know, when men saw him, he commanded respect. Now, one of the other generals that Wilson was considering was fighting Fred Funston, who was like 5 foot four, and although he was a brilliant tactician, probably smarter than Pershing actually at that, he just didn't look like a commanding general. And so all of these factors kind of came into play, but Pershing really proved himself in World War One. I mean, he had to essentially build an army from scratch. He had to maintain extraordinary discipline and serve as an example himself. And he was known, of course, as Blackjack. It started out as a more derogatory term because he had served with African American troops. But he eventually liked the name Blackjack because it suggested as something very tough, very rigid, which he was. But that's what I also wanted to show, is that he has this perception that he was this very cold individual, but underneath it, he wrote these beautiful letters to his son, you know, of how much he missed him. He eventually fell in love with another woman, which, you know, understandably, he was very lonely and had lost his family. And the love letters that he wrote to her, which I include in the book, are among the most beautiful love letters I ever read. One of the letters that I acquired, I'm actually going to donate to the Pershing Boyhood Home in Laclede. And so one of their staff members is coming up to Columbia and is going to accept the letter, and it'll be on permanent display at the Boyhood Home. But I just felt, you know, eventually all my Pershing letters are going to go to Chapman, where we have the Center for American War Letters. Mm-hmm. But I just symbolically, Denzel Haney, who's the one who's coming up to accept the letter, has been so helpful to me. And of course, he is the Pershing expert. He runs the Boyhood Home and knows everything about Pershing you could hope to know. So I just symbolically wanted to give something back to Missouri, because the state and because Denzel have just been so generous to me.
Reading the book gave me an opportunity to also find out a little bit more about another military leader with ties to this state. And people in central Missouri may not know anything about Leonard Wood, except, well, there's a Fort Leonard Wood just down the road. But you introduce us, and we learn quite a bit about General Leonard Wood, and he doesn't always come across as the most likable character.
Well, And look, he had his extraordinary traits about him. There's a very horrific story I tell where he was overwatching an exhibit of artillery, and he was almost killed in the process. There was an accident, and men around him were killed, and men were wounded too. And when the doctors rushed over to him, because he was the highest-ranking general that was part of this little viewing party for this artillery display, he said, "No, you tend to the other men first. They're more in more urgent need of care than I am." But he was a very temperamental guy. He was very political. He eventually did run for president, and he was really unbearable in a lot of ways. That when he came over, when Pershing was leading the AEF, and Wood felt that he should have been the leader of the American Expeditionary Forces. He kept berating Pershing, saying, "You should be doing it this way, and you should be doing that way." And when he was meeting with our allies, he was sort of undermining Pershing and other people in these conversations. And these are the types of things that Pershing would not do. He was a real gentleman. He, kept his politics within his staff and said, "This is what I think we should be doing." But I did want to focus on Leonard Wood. He's a very complicated character, but really fascinating character as well.
Indeed.
And so, yes, he was also someone I wanted to kind of bring to life through, what he had written in his letters and memoirs and so forth.
Andrew Carroll is our guest. The book, again, is called My Fellow Soldiers, and he will be in town this Saturday, a 1 o'clock program at the Courtyard by Marriott through the State Historical Society of Missouri. Again, their website is shsmo.org. Andy, you talk a lot about the political battle and getting the United States into the war, and so much of what makes this book interesting is a time when the written word was maybe more of a thing. You talked about how beautiful some of the love letters that General Pershing wrote, and the tenderness that he expressed for his son in these letters at a time when people wrote letters. And I found fascinating the conversations between President Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, and President Wilson. President Wilson getting reelected in large part on the platform of keeping the U.S. out of the war, and eventually it becomes clear that it's going to have to happen. And it may seem like a small point, but the speech in which Woodrow Wilson tries to sell the war he's opposed so fiercely, and includes that line that we're all so familiar with, making the world safe for democracy. And you talk about not just the ideas that were there coming from President Wilson rather than from a speechwriter, but the President of the United States sitting down at a typewriter and literally banging this speech out himself. Talk about the importance of that speech and Wilson, after being so opposed to the war, kind of being the guy that has to sell the American people on it.
When I was approaching this book, I kind of dreaded a lot of these parts because I figured, oh, this is all, this isn't the battle stuff. This is all the political back and forth and so forth. It turned out for me, just when I really delved into it, to be one of the most riveting chapters, and I call it Countdown, because there is this kind of sense that it really wasn't a question of if America was going to enter the war. It was a question of when and under what circumstances. And so I talk about how, Teddy Roosevelt was pushing for war very early on, and he was outwardly calling President Wilson a coward and yellow. And one quick little side note, you probably remember there's that section where once we finally declare war, Teddy Roosevelt really wanted to lead a division. And so
he went
sort of hat in hand to President Wilson, begging him to, let me lead forces in France. And Wilson was more than happy to say, no, you're not. And because he was so angered by the way Roosevelt had treated him beforehand. But, of course, then you have the Zimmerman telegram, which was captured by the British, and it was Germany's plot to work with Mexico and saying, listen, if you side with us, then you kind of cause trouble on the border to distract the Americans, we'll try and get you back some of the territory you lost in the Mexican-American War. But all of these behind-the-scenes machinations I thought were really fascinating. And just the story of the Zimmerman telegram, how the British didn't know how to tell the Americans because they actually kind of used our telegraph wires and spied on us, and they intercepted it, but they could figure out the code, and they eventually gave it to the Americans, and that really angered Wilson that the Germans were conspiring with the Mexicans. And so I really tried to almost write that like a thriller, where it's just, one thing after another leading up to it. And as you said, it's fascinating. This is a time where presidents wrote their own speeches, and Wilson slaved over that speech because the Zimmerman telegram happened a month before we declared war. Now, along with the telegram, the Germans started what they called unrestricted warfare, where they began sinking our ships, and that, right, of course, put Wilson over the top. But, what's interesting about World War I is there's no Pearl Harbor-like moment. There wasn't, they didn't attack us, and there was the Lusitania, but that was years before. And so it really was kind of a war that people were drawn in on principle, that they felt that we had to fight the Germans because of what they were doing to the French, to the Belgians, and so forth. And so it was a very different kind of war, and one, I think, that deserves a lot more scrutiny. It's been sort of overlooked by, I think, you know, by this country, but it really is a very fascinating and significant war. The map we live with today of the world, of Iraq, of Syria, of most of Europe, and other parts of the Middle East, was drawn during World War I, not World War II. And so it really is a war where we have the repercussions today. Even a young Ho Chi Minh, the later leader of the communist forces in Vietnam, was at the Treaty of Versailles begging the world powers to pay attention to his country. So, you know, these are the sorts of things I wanted to show with this war, why, as much as we kind of think it's just not that interesting, it really is a very fascinating and I think important and consequential war to look at. I do want to just say real quickly, and I appreciate your focus on the book, this is really part of a much larger project I run to save American war letters. That's my real passion, is to encourage veterans, encourage families who have letters, please save them. Or if you want to, you know, send copies to the Center for American War Letters, we have a very easy website to remember. It's just warletters.us. We focus on war letters, and we're proudly American, so warletters.us. And that'll tell you what we're looking for and so forth. But, you know, and it was during this search for war letters that I came across these correspondences by Pershing, which, again, no one had ever seen before except for his family members. And, you know, it's incredible to think of what's out there in people's attics and basements and closets. I was in Houston, and a woman gave me her grandfather's letters from World War I. The flooding then happened. She called me to say, if I had not given you our letters, we would have lost them in the flood.
Oh,
and
my.
That's what we're trying to do, is to save these voices, because whether it's a five-star general or it's a common private, we want the voices of these troops and their families to be preserved forever.
Fantastic. Well, that's certainly so. Remind us the URL again, warletters.us.
That's right. And if people want to bring letters to the talk on Saturday, I will be there to accept them. If someone, you know, kind of take their time and just send them to us, that's great. But I'm going to be showing, not just from World War II, but at the talk on Saturday, I'm going to be showing original letters dating back to the Revolution, from the Civil War, that people have shared with us. They're obviously in their protective sleeving, but people can come up and take pictures of them, can hold them. And I'm going to have letters by General Pershing, so people can come up, hold a letter by the general, and say, hey, I held a letter that was written by General John Pershing from World War I. And that's what I love about this project, is we make it very hands-on, and to show this is, you know, history in the first person. These are not, you know, third, you know, person accounts of, you know, writing about battles and the numbers and so forth. This is what it felt like to be in a trench, or to be under fire, or to be in a combat plane, you know, back when planes were new in 1914-15.
Yes.
I really wanted to bring war to life, and that's the whole purpose of My Fellow Soldiers, but most importantly, of the War Letters Project.
I am realizing at this point that the notes I have is going to lead to about a two-hour conversation, and so I'm kind of skipping around a little bit here. But you talked about airplanes, and it gets me back to a question I had thought of earlier, and that is the story of a few young Americans who joined the cause before the U.S. actually gets into the war. And I think our knowledge of the French Foreign Legion mostly comes from old movies and this forlorn lover who joins the Foreign Legion to escape the memory of dear Matilda or Edith or whoever it was.
Or to escape prison, which is in a lot of the cases they were going to go to jail otherwise,
But you tell remarkable stories of young men of means, of Harvard graduates and people from the best sort of family, of Vanderbilt, and some real incredible bravery and commitment to a cause that their own government wasn't yet behind.
I start the book, and it's one of them is called Lafayette's Boys, because they joined up because they felt they were rich, and they were living in France, they were studying, they had gone to Harvard or Yale, and so they had the means to be in Paris at the time just to study architecture and art and so forth. And when the war broke out in 1914, they felt very committed to France. They felt we owed them a debt because of Lafayette, who had come to help us during the American Revolution,
sure,
of course, then the French ships at Yorktown. And I really, I mean, for lack of a better word, board sort of fell in love with these guys because they were so patriotic and they were so dedicated to a cause. And first they joined the Foreign Legion, and that was just the most horrific experience you can imagine because they were there on the front lines in the trenches and they were getting machine gunned and so forth. And but, you know, someone like Eugene Bullard, who was the first African-American combat pilot, his name should be as famous as Charles Lindbergh. You know, he was the first. He put his life on the line, and he's been, you know, really kind of eclipsed in history. But what I really wanted to kind of show people was not just the heroism of these guys, but how terrifying flying was back then. This was in 1915. Planes were very new, and it began where they just did reconnaissance missions because the planes were not armed. They had no guns on them. Then eventually they put machine guns on them and so forth, and so you had dogfights and all this riveting thing. But, you know, these were open-air cockpits. It was freezing up there, and they were going through the most strenuous circumstances you can imagine. And so I wanted to kind of give people a sense of both the exhilaration and the terror of being a pilot back in those early years and the kind of aircraft they were using. Then when the war starts, I talk about Eddie Rickenbacker and, you know, some of the more well-known aces and so forth. But yeah, those early pilots to me were real heroes in what they went through. And again, many of them did not come back. It was a real, you were truly putting your life on the line at that time.
We talked about Leonard Wood being a complicated character, and we also see some of the depth and complication of Woodrow Wilson. The chapter Blackjack and the Hellfighters is hard to read, and we hear about the race riots in East St. Louis, battles between black soldiers and law enforcement in Houston and then in Spartanburg. And people have to remember, this is a time when a lot of race problems were being inflamed. This is the era of Birth of the Nation and when the Ku Klux Klan kind of was rekindled.
Revived.
Again.
Yep.
And the point that struck me in that, I am from Oklahoma and really, really proud of that. Oklahoma history was my favorite class in school. I took an honors class in Oklahoma history in high school. I studied Oklahoma history in college, and there was almost no mention of the Tulsa race riot of 1921.
Right.
The stuff you're talking about here is hugely significant. I'd never heard of any of this stuff.
Well, and I was familiar with the Tulsa race riots. It wasn't as relevant to World War I, although it was post-war. But I really wanted to give a sense of what these African-American troops were put through, not just military-wise, but just the racism they encountered. These were men who joined the Army, and they volunteered. They were not just drafted. These were men who enlisted because they wanted to prove themselves. And this was kind of the nascent civil rights movement. We always, we focus on the 50s and the 60s. These men went off to fight because they wanted to prove to their country that we will risk our lives for America, really kind of hoping and expecting, as they should, that when they came back, they would be treated as heroes. The opposite was true. And, you know, so even in the whole, the beginning part of the war, a lot of white racists were furious at the idea that we were arming black men. We were training them how to shoot, how to fire, how to, go into combat. And they were terrified by this. So you mentioned, Spartanburg. So when people were in South Carolina, you had these masses of African-American divisions, and they were terrified by this. But the African-American troops, performed brilliantly. And again, I talk about Eugene Bullard, but also one of my favorite characters, James Reese Europe, and who was a musician. He was a Harlem band conductor. He joined up as a machine gunner. And tragically, I don't get into this story so much because it is very sad, but he survived the war, and then he was stabbed by another musician in Boston during a fight. So he had this very sad fate. James Reese Europe is the man who brought jazz to France and to other parts of the continent. And so he was a very influential figure, but he volunteered. He wanted to prove himself. And so, I didn't put the story in because I felt like, this is something I have to cover. It's because these men deserve the attention. And they were just so extraordinary in what they were willing to volunteer and to sacrifice. And I wanted to make sure that was part of the overall World War I story, because it really is quite relevant.
My Fellow Soldiers is the title of the book. Andrew Carroll, our guest again. He'll be in town Saturday, 1:00, over at Courtyard by Marriott, State Historical Society of Missouri, welcoming him to town. We've talked before Andy, about the fact that this book personalizes a lot of the war rather than big numbers and troop totals and the names of battles, but individual soldiers and nurses and doctors. And one of the stories I found very profound was that of the death of Quentin Roosevelt, the youngest son of President Theodore Roosevelt. And you talk so much about the political things and his very rough nature with President Wilson. And to read of old Rough Rider, the Bull Moose, pining for his youngest son and sending tender replies to people who had written him notes of condolence, that was remarkable.
Yeah, that story really moved me. I mean, you know, Roosevelt is a very complicated figure, too. And some people, you know, they're talking about taking down his statues across the country and stuff like that because he believed in eugenics and he wasn't great on race relations. You know, but Teddy Roosevelt had his admirable qualities as well. And, you know, and I focus on both. I don't gloss over anybody's faults or, you know, how they're complicated. I mean, Pershing himself was complicated on race
sure.
issues. But, I wanted to just humanize the Roosevelt story because all of his boys went off to fight. And in the postscript of the book, I talk about how, you know, Archie was over there and Ted Jr. was over there and so forth, and even Teddy's daughter-in-law, who was serving as a nurse. But Quentin was his youngest. And Quentin, so the other boys went off to fight infantry, and Quentin wanted to fly. And his letters, which I quote from, I just thought were so beautiful and so poetic about what it was like to fly. And there were even these little dashes of humor where he talked about how freezing it was up there. And he's like, I don't understand how the angels bear it. But he eventually was shot down. And it was interesting because, and I didn't go into too much detail about this, but the Germans were very respectful that the son of a president would fight for his country. So they gave him a funeral with full military, sort of ceremony and so forth. And Teddy decided that Quentin should remain in Europe to be buried. He did not bring him back to the U.S. But a little anecdote I throw in, which I thought was interesting, is that they did retrieve the mangled axle of Quentin's plane, and they put it on display at the Roosevelt home in Oyster Bay. But what I thought was especially poignant about the story were the letters that Roosevelt, Teddy, and Pershing wrote to each other. And Pershing knew Quentin, and he too was heartsick that this boy was shot down, and he was really hoping that he was taken as a prisoner of war, that he was not killed. Then they finally got verification from the Germans that mm-hmm. Quentin was in fact dead. And so Pershing wrote to Roosevelt a very poignant letter about, you know, I'm so sorry about your loss. And Roosevelt wrote back remembering, you know, we're kind of coming back to what we talked about in the beginning, remembering that Pershing had lost his wife and three little girls. He said, you know, my friend, you have lost way, you know, endured much more suffering than I have.
Yes.
And you bore it with extraordinary courage, and I only wish I could emulate your example. And I do talk about how, as much as Roosevelt was very pro-war and, you know, very gung-ho about fighting, that the loss of Quentin really in some ways may have exacerbated his own passing away, because he died just months later, many people say, of a broken heart. And so it's a very human story. Whatever you think about Roosevelt politically, this is a father who's lost his son, and that's what I wanted to kind of to convey as powerfully as possible.
And then one other story I want to mention, and it's later in the book. We get more of the military war stuff, the late forward push by the U.S. and Allied troops. And then the chapter All In, you talk about a unit pinned down by snipers. They're taking shells, friendly fire, and they're facing German snipers. And the only way they can get word out is through carrier pigeons. Tell the story about Cher Ami.
So this is about the Lost Battalion. It's a pretty well-known story. I tried to tell it a little bit differently, just to, you know, for those who are familiar with it, to give it a different angle. But yeah, their only means of communication was to send up these carrier pigeons. They only had a couple. The first two were shot. You know, the minute they went up, the Germans just shot them out of the air. And the third pigeon, Cherami, who they tied a final message to, one saying where their position was and saying, stop firing on us, because
right.
the Americans were shooting on their own people, not knowing that's where they were. And I think the officer was like, you know, for the love of God, please stop. It was very, very, it wasn't like a military message. It was just like, you know, person to person.
Yeah.
And Cherami was shot through the leg, but finally made it, you know, however many, I think it was 20 miles away or something. And so the Lost Battalion was finally preserved. But it's a really compelling story. And just quickly, because I feel this is a story, and I think it's tied in with Oklahoma because they're from, this is where this tribe was from. But a lot of people talk about the Navajo Kotakers
yes.
in World War II. what's gone completely over, I think, unknown is the Choctaw code talkers from World War One. That we use the Choctaw language as part of our military code during the Meuse-Argonne offensive. And as much as I say that, you know, this is a very personalized view of war, I don't overlook the major battles. I mean, I just talk about them from a more personal standpoint. So, of course, you've got the Battle of St. Mihiel and then the Meuse-Argonne offensive at the end. But the letters I have from that really give you a sense of how intense the fighting was and that this was the last major push to the war that turned the tide. And, you know, the Americans were instrumental in, I think, bringing victory to the Allies. It was kind of this fresh infusion of young, energetic soldiers, unlike the French and the British, who understandably were just worn down after 3 years of fighting. But the Americans came in and really turned the tide, and I think, you know, they deserve their due on that. And Pershing himself very much was responsible for saying the Americans are going to fight under their flag, you know, in one army. We're not going to scatter them around, you know, in the British and the French troops, where they're going to fight as Americans. And it was one of the most consequential decisions of the war, and I think he proved himself correct in that.
And you're kind of leading into my final question, which is that the book's subtitle is General John Pershing and the Americans Who Helped Win the Great War. At the end of the day, you talked already about the importance of the U.S. entry into World War One. How do you feel like it changed this nation?
It really is what turned America for the first time into a world power. Now, obviously, we had the Spanish-American War, and Teddy Roosevelt had said what sent the sort of the white navy across the globe to show our military prowess. But this, we helped win a world war. And when Wilson came over to help dictate the Treaty of Versailles, some of the Europeans took offense at this because they felt like you guys kind of came in at the end. We were here all 4 years. But they also recognized it was the Americans who made the difference and who won the war. It would have been a stalemate, and Germany probably would have ended up with Belgium and most of France. And we won't get into the whole, you know, the ramifications of the Treaty of Versailles. That's a whole much longer conversation.
Yes.
But the Americans really came in at what was a stalemate. In fact, even the Germans were encroaching on Paris, and we held them back. And so there's just no question that it was the American involvement that led to the victory of that war. And again, we had a very small military before World War One. In fact, we even kind of receded a bit, and to Pershing's, I think, disapproval, cut back on the military forces so that when World War II came around, he still felt that we were not prepared, that we should have been a larger power. But those two conflicts, of course, are what brought America to the world stage and showed that we were a world power and very much worthy of the respect that we started to earn throughout the globe.
Well, we could go on a lot more. There are some very interesting stories, as we've already mentioned, about Harry Truman, about Patton, about MacArthur. There's, if you're interested in world history and military history, it's fascinating, but it's also the story that reminds us that at the end of the day, yes, this was a war in which more than 1 million people were killed, but all of them had a sweetheart, a mother, somebody that cared about them, and it very much personalizes what happened there. It is a wonderful read. The book, again, is called My Fellow Soldiers by Andrew Carroll, and you can see him in town. It's going to be Saturday. 1 o'clock is the program. They do ask that you register ahead of time through the State Historical Society of Missouri, SHSMO.org, and it'll happen at the Courtyard by Marriott and Conference Center in Columbia. The author is Andrew Carroll. Andy, you've been very generous with your time. I enjoyed visiting with you an awful lot. Safe travels, and we'll see you in town this weekend.
Thank you so much. I feel like we could just keep talking.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate it. We hit all the really important things. Again, just the War Letters Project, too. But thank you so much for helping us spread the word, not just about the book, but about the overall project. You know, these letters, to me, are America's great undiscovered literature. And our mission is to seek them out before they're lost and to give them a safe home where they'll be preserved forever and that we'll never forget the sacrifices of our troops and our veterans.